Before we go into our first case, which is Kenneth Pugh and Chad Boylan versus the Tribune Company, out of an abundance of caution, I would like to let everyone know that for a few years I was on a nonprofit board. I served on a nonprofit board, the Illinois Institute of Technology's Board of Trustees, with John Madigan. I am certain that Mr. Madigan and I never said more than hello. Maybe we say goodbye once in a while, but I have had no other relationship whatsoever with him. But if anyone has a problem with that, they can, you know, let me know later. Let us know later. But I think the board has about 150 members. All right. He is no longer on that board. I don't know precisely when he left it, but it would be at least 4 or 5 years ago. All right. Ms. Savitt, come on up.
May it please the court, I represent the securities litigation plaintiffs, not the ERISA case. And I will. We have allocated our time so that I have 14 minutes.
Right, and 3 for rebuttal, so just watch the white light.
Okay. May it please the court, I wish to argue 4 points. First, that defendant Cito, his scienter should be imputed to defendant Tribune according to Judge Posner's recent Tell Labs decision. Second point, that plaintiffs have properly pled a 10b-5 claim against defendant Cito since he was a primary participant in the securities fraud. Third point, plaintiffs have properly pled scienter by alleging cogent and compelling facts supporting recklessness against Tribune defendants CEO Fitzsimons and CFO Grenesco. And finally, the fourth point, if the complaint is not accepted in its present form, leave to amend should be granted because it is not futile. Facts came to light after the second amended complaint was filed, and plaintiffs have not had any opportunity to correct perceived deficiencies. The first point, defendant Cito's scienter should be imputed to defendant Tribune Company. Cito, as pled, was a Tribune officer. He was the vice president of Hispanic Media. He was the president and CEO of DSA Community Publishing, a subsidiary. He was the CEO and publisher of OI, the Spanish newspaper, and the vice president in charge of circulation of Newsday.
Now, of course, he was not responsible for filing any of the 10K or 10Q reports.
That's true, Your Honor.
How does that factor in?
It factors in because he supplied the false information, the false circulation numbers that were reissued in the 10Ks and that led to false revenue and earnings that was also published in the SEC reports. He directly contributed to the false statements that were in the publicly filed SEC reports and press releases.
So it's your view, I take it, that you have linked up someone who knew about the fraud with someone who was responsible for making false statements in the SEC filings.
Yes, and in fact, it is our belief that he contributed to making those false statements. The false circulation numbers were submitted to the ABC, the Audit Bureau of Circulation, which themselves published those statements publicly. And it was known that those exact circulation numbers would be reissued in the 10Ks, and the revenue numbers derived therefrom would be in the 10Ks and 10Qs. So he directly participated. That gives him direct 10b-5 liability. There's no issue about his scienter. He pled guilty. The facts show that he was the mastermind of the fraud. But from so that gives him the direct. That's point two. We have pled direct 10b-5 liability for him. But point one is that his scienter should be imputed to Tribune under Tell Labs. He was acting within the scope of his employment and in attempted furtherance of the employer's goals. That goal was Tribune's goal to raise circulation and revenue numbers. And under Judge Posner's decision...
It's Posner. Posner, and it's an opinion from the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals, from Judge Posner.
Yes, thank you, Your Honor. Since he met those conditions, acting within the scope of his employment and in furtherance of the employer's goals, under the principles of respondeat superior and agency, which he says in his opinion are applicable to securities fraud, his scienter is imputed to Tribune, and therefore Tribune is properly pled as a defendant and has scienter through CITO. That opinion, the most relevant part, which I'd just like to quote, says, to establish corporate liability for a violation of Rule 10b-5 requires looking to the state of mind of the individual corporate official or officials who make or issue statements or order or approve it or its making or issuance or who furnish information or language for inclusion therein. And as I said, CITO gave those false circulation numbers to the ABC, which were included in the 3 years of Tribune 10K reports and affected the revenue calculations, which were included in all the 10Ks and 10Qs. CITO was a corporate officer and senior corporate manager. But Posner says that...
No, it's not Posner.
Posner.
You're missing the point.
I'm sorry.
The fact that Judge Posner was on the panel that issued the opinion doesn't mean it's Judge Posner's opinion. It's an opinion from the Court of Appeals of the Seventh Circuit.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'm sorry. The Seventh Circuit opinion says that even if he were a lower-level employee, if he met the conditions of acting within the scope of his employment and in furtherance of corporate goals, his scienter should be imputed to the corporation. And that was what was lacking, according to the district court, that there was no way...
Well, it seemed to me that that would make more sense if what he was doing was to the advantage of the corporation. But if you're taking a case like this where you're exposing the company to significant damage claims by advertisers who are basing their payments on these inflated circulation numbers, you're not acting to the benefit of the company, are you?
It's different than somebody who's embezzling money for himself. There's no allegation of that. He was trying to raise the revenue numbers and the circulation numbers.
He was raising them. No, he wasn't trying to. He was raising them.
Right, but he viewed that...
And once that came to light... The company is exposed to significant damage claims by the advertisers who paid based on the circulation figures. Isn't that correct?
That is true, Your Honor. But looking at it a different way, increasing the circulation numbers and the revenues was a corporate goal. And he may have done that in an unlawful fashion by falsifying the numbers. But he wasn't doing something for himself. He wasn't taking money or embezzling money. He was doing something for the corporation, albeit illegal. And I believe that that would qualify for imputing his scienter to the corporation.
Was there anything regarding his future? Was it dependent on his being head of this Hispanic arm to continue the success of that particular newspaper? That it would benefit him and his job in order to inflate them as far as the higher-ups were concerned in the company?
Your Honor, there are no facts on the record that state that. But one can only presume that if somebody is getting good numbers for the subsidiary that they work for and is in charge on a corporate level of Hispanic media, of which OI, the newspaper, was an important part, that this would benefit him in his standing with the corporation if he were to produce good numbers. So I think that that could be inferred.
He's deceiving the higher-ups, then.
Yes. However, that leads me into the next argument, which is that I believe that we have properly pled a 10b-5 claim against the higher-ups, the CEO and the CFO, because they were reckless in failing to ensure that there were adequate controls to detect such frauds. And they had a motive for being lax, and their motive was that their bonuses were directly tied to the cash flows of the company, which flowed from the circulation numbers and the revenues.
You know, Ms. Savitt, you seem to be arguing that the people running the ERISA plan should have discovered the fraud and then used that knowledge to either divest the plan of Tribune stock or stop investing in Tribune stock before the rest of the market learned of the scandal. And that sounds a little bit like insider trading. If that is not your argument, then what action should the plan have taken when it learned of the fraud in order to avoid this
She's
charge?
She's only arguing
of,
the securities case, not
oh,
the
you're
ERISA
not,
case.
You are only arguing the securities case. I'm sorry.
I'm only arguing the securities case. But
well, keep whoever's arguing, keep that in mind.
I would like to state the facts that we have pled in support of the Scienter allegation against the CEO and the CFO, and want to make it clear that in that context we're talking about recklessness, not knowledgeable fraud, as we are with regard to defendant Cito. We have pled that weak controls existed all during the class period, specifically that unlike other publishers, Tribune did not require during this class period that circulation figures be certified. And that's in paragraphs 135 and 126 of the complaint. We have alleged that the CEO and the CFO were reckless because they ignored red flags. And specifically, those red flags were that agents, distributors, managers, and employees from within had complained for years about bogus subscribers. That is found in paragraph 59.5. Another red flag is that we have pled is that sales revenues did not correlate with the circulation numbers reported to the Audit Bureau of Circulation and contained in the SEC filings. The third red flag is that controls and procedures in place did not ascertain that Newsday and Oi were using fictitious hawkers and vendors. That allegation is found at paragraph 135. A fourth red flag is that the internal auditors could not confirm circulation numbers from fictitious hawkers. As to red flags 3 and 4, there was insufficient testing and sampling embedded in the controls to detect these problems, and all of that is at paragraph 135. Another fact that we have pled...
for this?
I'm sorry?
Wasn't there an outside auditor, independent auditor, doing some sort of, I don't know what they do, but somebody besides the board determines what the circulation is and the methods and that sort of thing.
Well, the internal auditors actually are charged with that duty, and the outside auditors do certain testing and sampling to make sure that internally it's done properly. But we're just looking.
Who are the outside auditors?
I don't know, Your Honor. They haven't been named in this complaint.
I know, but I
don't know that off the top.
But the fact is they exist. Somebody's relying on outside auditors, or at least that's one method of determining whether or not these are proper circulation.
But the function of outside auditors, not to divert too much, Your Honor, is to do much more limited testing and sampling. They rely heavily on management's financial statements and management's controls. And it is pled here that they were inadequate and didn't have proper controls in place to detect such a massive fraud as this. It was not a small fraud. Newsday's circulation numbers, it turned out, were exaggerated by 50%. Pardon me. Oi's by 50% and Newsday's by 20%. Another fact supporting recklessness is the company's own admission at the end of its investigative process that started in February 2004 when the company was sued by its advertisers. But the company admitted in the end that there were a wide range of issues affecting the circulation numbers, including poor documentation and records mismanagement. That's found at paragraph 126 of the complaint. Another fact supporting the recklessness of the executives is that ABC, the independent audit board that certifies these numbers, censured Newsday and Oi. And it is pled that it's the first time they censured a company in decades, and they were censured for improper circulation practices. That's found at paragraph 122.1 and paragraph 124.
When did that occur?
I'm sorry?
When did that censure occur?
The censure occurred in June of 2004.
Well, that's after all this came to light, then.
That's right. Because when everybody dug in and started to investigate, when the advertisers sued, when the SEC opened up an informal investigation, and when criminal investigations started, and when they dug in, they found that there were massive control problems. And, in fact, the SEC sued Tribune in an enforcement action alleging violations of Section 13A, 13B2A, and B2B of the Securities Exchange Act of 1934 by failing to maintain adequate controls, the existence of which would have enabled Tribune to have detected the fraudulently inflated paid circulation numbers that Newsday and Oi reported to the SEC and were republished in public securities filings and reports to ABC. That suit was settled with Tribune, and that's found in the record at A2002 to 2005 in the U.S. Attorney press release issued May 30, 2006. But the point is that the SEC said that Tribune had failed to have adequate controls which would have allowed them to detect this fraud. And ultimately, the CEO and CFO are in charge of those controls, and here they issued false Sarbanes-Oxley certifications almost to the end, almost to the final disclosure of the $90 million workout write-down, that the controls were efficacious, that they were designed by them or supervised by them to detect fraud, and that all fraud had been reported. But in fact, that wasn't the case. The controls were lax throughout the period, and the facts that I've just set forth, which are contained in the record, are compelling and cogent facts supporting a finding, at least for pleadings purposes, of recklessness in the two chief executive officers, the CEO and the CFO.
You know, forgive me, Ms. Savitt, I will give you an extra minute, but you've pretty much used up your rebuttal time. So,
okay. Last final point, Your Honor, is that they continue to make, the chief executives kept making false statements, issuing the false circulation reports, issuing the false revenue statements, even after February 2004 when they began an investigation and they issued unqualified Sarbanes-Oxley certifications. And that is reckless when you're in the middle of an investigation to continue to make unqualified positive statements and issue numbers when you're investigating those very numbers. They should have remained silent or said, this is in the process of an investigation. But instead, unlike the Baxter case, they just kept on making false positive statements. Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Mills.
The ERISA case is not subject to any kind of a heightened pleading standard. We only had to show that we had a plausible claim to some kind of relief. The trial court basically said that the circulation scandal was just too small in a number of ways. It was too small to be picked up by the 401k committee members. It was, if you will, below their level. And it was too small to warrant or mandate the disposal, the liquidation of the stock position. But that is not a fair basis to dismiss this case. The stock market put a tremendous value on the circulation problems and the inadequate.
What action should the plan have taken when it learned of the fraud in order to avoid this charge of imprudence? I started my question earlier regarding the possibility that it might be viewed as insider trading.
It can't be insider trading. Okay, the fiduciaries could not dump the stock on an unsuspecting market. You can't do that. It's unlawful. We're not saying they should have. But they can disclose and sell. And disclose, you don't have to wait days. Disclose and sell in an orderly fashion. Would there have been a market decline? Probably. Would it have been the market decline that happened here? Probably not, because the market decline here is very much affected by the company denying that there was a problem in the first place. If you look at 111 of our complaint, when the class action, the RICO class action, is filed by the advertisers, the very next day the company issues a press release. It doesn't say we're going to investigate this. It says this lawsuit is entirely false. It's based on a disgruntled former employee. And then what happens is gradually the market sees that's not what's going on. And 6 months later, the company says our numbers are wrong. And some months after that, you have the SEC consent decree. The company says, yeah, our numbers are wrong. But if
you know,
the company...
You tell us that the stock fell, I don't know, 47 or something to 40 during this period of time. And that 40 is a snapshot in...
39, I think.
Oh, okay. What happened to the stock after that?
It does go up, but for unrelated events. It's not as though...
How do you know that it didn't go down for... At least part of this downturn is not attributable to the circulation matter.
Your Honor, I do believe that if the case is remanded, that would be a point of legitimate conflicting evidence. We got tossed out on the pleadings. We don't even get a chance to put any evidence. Mm-hmm. What we do have here is before the class action is filed in late 2003, the stock is trading in the low 50s. Over the next 9 months, it trends downward as news begins to come out about the problem, and it hits 39. That's a 25% drop. There's $1.1 billion in the plan in employer stock. It's a very substantial loss. I think what the lower court said it wasn't important, but the market said it was important. But can I get back to the question? The fiduciary should have disclosed and sold. Okay. They also should have disclosed and not sold so that at least people would have had a chance to get out of the stock. What the trial court said is you have a good disclosure claim here, except, again, it's just too small. It was too small a matter to reach the attention of the 401k committee.
What was the most serious red flag that was apparent to the plan fiduciaries, do you think?
I think it's two things. Certainly the class action lawsuit in February of 2004, but also what we have here is we have two people on the 401k committee, Mr. Grinesco and Mr. Granat. They're on the committee. And they signed the Sarbanes-Oxley certifications. It's they're certifying that the company's internal controls are adequate. It's their job to understand that. And according to the admissions of the company in the consent decree, going back to at least 2002, if not earlier, the internal controls are they're not adequate. We know that. That's been admitted. And I'm a little bit off point now, but there was a suggestion by Ms. Savette in her argument about a possibility of amended pleadings. That certainly applies to this case because our complaint is October 05. We don't have the consent decree or the guilty pleas until sometime the next year. We got thrown out, we say, really because of a misreading of the law by the trial court. But to get back to the question, disclose and sell, disclose or not sell so people have a chance. Also, at least stop further investment in the plan.
What does it disclose?
Disclose would be we have a problem. I don't know how exactly you word it. But
contrary to whatever the management's saying or something like that.
Yes, we have a problem here. our best estimate is that it may be just a few rogue employees, or maybe it's something more widespread. Whatever the facts are to disclose them fairly so that people can make informed judgments about staying in or getting out of the stock plan.
Well, you know, I mean, of course, you're arguing that the plan fiduciaries had a duty to both investigate and discover the fraud. And where precisely does that duty arise from? In other words, what is the source of that duty?
I think it's in Section 404, duty of prudence. Prudent management of a 401k plan requires that the actions that a reasonable person would take in the protection of his or her own money. In this case, once the class action is filed and there's an issue raised publicly about maybe the numbers are wrong, there's a duty to investigate, find out what the truth is. I don't want to belabor the point, but the company said this is all from a disgruntled employee. Does that sound like a management that's devoted to finding out what the truth is? We didn't get the benefit of that inference in the trial court.
But precisely what were the red flags? I'm still trying to wrap myself around
just
that.
Two, the class action complaint and the fact that these internal control inadequacies went on as long as they did. They go back several years. This is not an isolated instance. It's not a one-time event. You have people with a responsibility, especially the two individuals I named, to understand what's going on. Those are the two red flags.
Were there earlier exposures of, we'll call it overcounting?
I don't believe so. I don't believe that's alleged.
Now, I don't know if you'll concede this, but this was a small amount of revenue compared to the Tribune's total revenues.
It's 15% of the publishing revenue.
So
less than that as a total.
Where, you know, what reason should there have been to think that the scandal would, let's say, significantly affect the stock price?
Well, I think for one thing, you can see it is affecting the stock price as it trends down continuously. So maybe if you don't know on day one, if you say, well, it's too small to affect the market, but you can see as time goes on, it is affecting the market. And, you know, again, the complaint here, we were tossed out, you know, from the whole way, from beginning to end.
In the final analysis, was the money recouped on the stock?
I guess it would depend on if you take it out to, you know, very recent events, it probably would.
To Mr. Zell.
Right, to Mr. Zell. But it's like in securities cases. There comes a cutoff point where you say basically it's a new investment decision. It's
and
the
where would that be
broken.
In your view?
I would say that would be year-end it would be September 04. September 04.
You want to take that snapshot of September of 04 and that and not consider anything that happened after?
Well, I wouldn't say not consider. I just think that's really where just about all the bad news has come out and the market has absorbed it.
And
seems to
well, my question was, and might not have all that significant a bearing on the case, but where was the stock price 90 days or 2 months or 6 months or so after that?
It has substantially rebounded. I think that's in the record. The question is that connected to this case or is it extraneous events?
Yeah, well, the same question is the slippage in the stock price connected to this or not. I mean, who knows?
Legitimate fact questions, maybe for something post-pleading. Do I have time? I don't.
Yeah, you're doing fine.
You're,
okay.
You're doing great.
Okay.
You're doing better than Miss Abbott did.
Miss Abbott's going to get an extra minute.
Well,
now you see, now you're into your rebuttal. So you might want to sit down.
Thank you.
And again, you might not want to. You know, I'm not supposed to.
I'm going to save the Summers Against State Street for rebuttal. Thank you.
No. We're going to give. Do they do this differently in the Third Circuit?
Maybe you want to rebut what Mr. Mill said.
So now, Mr. Graham.
Hello. May it please the court. My name is David Graham, and I represent certain defendants in these cases. I'm going to start with the ERISA case and then turn to the securities case. And let me start by saying the district court correctly dismissed the ERISA complaint because at its core, the complaint is based on a patently erroneous legal theory with absolutely no support anywhere else that would transform the scope of fiduciary duties under ERISA and leave them virtually indistinguishable from operational duties.
Well, maybe you could start out by explaining what exactly Mr. Sito's role in the Tribune Company was. In other words, what is a vice president for Hispanic media? Where does he fall on the organizational chart? Is he up there with all the other vice presidents?
Your Honor, with respect, that's a question that pertains to the securities case,
okay,
and I'm happy I will address that as soon as I get to the securities case. Okay. There aren't allegations regarding Mr. Sito in the ERISA case. That's not an issue in connection with the ERISA case.
It's just that I keep wondering about him.
And I'm going to I will get to that, Your Honor, if it's okay to defer that question. As Your Honor quite correctly asked, what's the source of the duty? Because here, I mean, plaintiff's theory, and it's spelled out at the top of page 21 of their opening brief, was that, quote, the defendants, had they earlier conducted an investigation, would also have unearthed the overstatements of circulation at Newsday and Oi. And the question then became, well, what responsibility is there, what legal authority is there for sua sponte asking ERISA fiduciaries to re-audit or conduct audits of underlying companies' operations? And there is none, except in the instance where there are potentially red flags, at which point, if there are red flags that raise a question of the continued prudence of the investment, a fiduciary may have an obligation to take steps. Now, that underlying theory was the basis, though, that there is some sui sponte obligation to be a roving auditor that the district court correctly rejected. Now, plaintiffs then addressed the question that Your Honor asked Judge Rovner. Well, what are the red flags here, and what's the most serious ones in terms of the red flags here? And there is one red flag here that is listed in the complaint. I understate. There are two statements in the complaint that go to that. First, there's a claim that the internal controls were so, quote-unquote, obviously deficient because they allowed this to take place that the defendants should have known that there was something amiss. That's nothing more, though, than a conclusory and circular assertion, saying that the internal controls were inadequate to prevent the fraud, as this court recognized recently in the Higginbotham versus Baxter case. There's no set of controls that's going to prevent a determined and deliberate fraud by employees underneath. The fact that the fraud occurred doesn't say anything about the adequacy of the controls. And the point that Mr. Mills made, where he said one of the quote-unquote red flags is that this activity allegedly had been going on at the subsidiary level for several years, that doesn't say anything by way of a red flag that would have reached the members of the committee and the other ERISA fiduciaries. So what is the red flag then? The single red flag that is identified is in paragraph 95D of the complaint. And they say that the company, and I'm quoting, did not even require that circulation managers certify the claim circulation. Now, with all respect, Your Honors, this is nothing more than the plaintiffs having seized upon an additional step that, as the complaint itself reveals, Tribune instituted after this fraud came to light. Mr. Fitzsimons, the CEO of Tribune, after this fraud came to light, and it's set forth in the complaint, in June of 2004, instituted an additional requirement that on a quarterly basis that there be certifications from the managers of various publications as to their circulation figures. Now, that's not to say there were no controls in place before then. As Your Honor quite correctly indicated, there are outside auditors that audited. There are internal auditors that audited. ABC audited. There were, in fact, certifications by people to ABC. This is simply an additional step. So let's assume for one second, let's assume, and there's no pleaded basis for this, that the fiduciaries knew that there was not an additional requirement of quarterly certifications. Does that somehow spell out a red flag that there is actual fraud occurring at the subsidiary level? Of course not. And that's true as a matter of law. That's not a reasonable inference. That's not something that passes the plausibility standard. And Judge Hart was quite correct in saying the single red flag, purported red flag that you've identified, doesn't get you to that level. That's this case in a nutshell. Because their entire theory was not that any of the fiduciaries had any information in their possession that disclosed this. Instead, the theory was you should have gone out and done an investigation and would have unearthed it, which is legally fallacious, and their one red flag was this alleged lack of a circulation certification that was, in fact, added after the fact. Now, I heard one other point raised in the oral argument just now, and that was the notion that at least there should have been a red flag after February 2004. Mind you, however, Your Honors, this class action or this complaint here dates back to December 31st, 2002 in terms of the allegations. But they say once the advertisers filed a lawsuit, that should have been a red flag. Well, Your Honors, in connection with that, the fact of the matter is two comments. To begin with, there's simply a misstatement in terms of the record. They say that Tribune issued a denial saying it was due to a disgruntled employee. That was not Tribune Company. That was the Newsday Company, which is a separate subsidiary, and Newsday's publisher who issued that. But more importantly, the question then becomes, what did an ERISA fiduciary do wrong here? As soon as that advertiser's lawsuit comes in, it's undisputed. It's in the complaint itself and in the documents referred to. Tribune Company itself launched an investigation as a follow-up to that. ABC, the Audit Bureau of Circulation, launched an investigation. And it happened to take them some months in order to discover what was going on because, again, as the complaint itself reveals, this was a very elaborate fraud.
When did ABC initiate that?
In February of 2004, after the...
You said something about 2002, a class action was underway.
The complaint here purports to date back to December of 2002.
Okay.
So what they're seeking is basically anybody who invested in the Tribune plan from the employee perspective back to December 2002. So where's the imprudence?
You argue that the stock price didn't fluctuate very much. But absent the fraud, it might have actually gone up during that time period. In other words, how can we know, sitting here, what would have happened absent the fraud? Shouldn't that uncertainty be construed in the plaintiff's favor at this point of the pleadings?
Your Honor, this is a third tier argument, both in the opinion below and in our brief. Because if there is no duty and if there are no red flags, you don't reach that argument.
Maybe we will.
I understand.
So
what Judge Hart, I believe, was saying was simply this. Even if, counter to everything I just said, there was some reason to know of that, plaintiff's suggestion, and it's in their complaint, they say what should have happened once you know was you should have dumped the stock. That would not be imprudent not to dump the stock at that point because this is not the kind of significant event that would cause it to be imprudent to maintain that as an option within the plan. And all he was doing in addressing that tertiary argument is saying the plaintiff's own complaint lets me know that that's the case, given the strict standards and the presumptions under MENCH, where a fiduciary that has an obligation to maintain an option under a plan, and here the plans required that this be an option, that be offered, is supposed to act in accordance with the plan unless doing so is so clearly imprudent that no reasonable person would do that. And he said, even if we were to reach that hypothetical argument here, the facts that they've pleaded and that are of record in terms of the stock price movements are sufficient to let me know you haven't reached that threshold in terms of that. But that's a tertiary argument.
Now, are you willing to answer any questions about Mr. Seto? Or
going to turn to the securities case?
Is there someone out there that isn't listed that's going to...
You have me and only me, Your Honor.
Okay, well, go to it. Help me with him, because I'm trying to understand where he fits in. Are all vice presidents created equal?
Your Honor, let me start with Mr. Seto because you asked. And there are several things to say about Mr. Seto. The first point about Mr. Seto, and it's a point that we made in our brief, but I want to underscore it here, is there's a certain gamesmanship that's being played here in terms of talking about his various capacities. Yes, Mr. Seto bore a title of Vice President of Hispanic Media. No, Your Honor, not all vice presidents are created equal. Tribune's got lots of them floating around, and a vice president is not an executive office. What matters...
The vice president is not an executive officer in the Tribune's of command.
That's right. The executive officers are laid out, in fact, in the 10-Ks, and we cite it. The listings in the 10-K, you'll see Mr. Seto's not there. But for these purposes, here's what's relevant. Mr. Seto wore... His primary hats were at Hoy, which is a subsidiary. He was publisher, CEO, etc. Now, there is one act that Mr. Seto is alleged to have undertaken in this complaint. It's set forth in paragraph 21.2 of the securities complaint, the Second Amendment complaint. That act is that Mr. Seto is alleged to have certified to ABC the circulation figures of Hoy. So even if we were dealing just with Seto, remember that only the OI statements would be relevant. So here we have one act. Now the question is, what capacity did Mr. Seto take that act in connection with? And the complaint itself reveals the answer, and I'll explain why it's important in just a second. The complaint says in paragraph 42, publishers are required to certify their paid circulation numbers to ABC every 6 months. Publishers. And Mr. Seto was the publisher of OI. That was one of his titles. So when Mr. Seto takes the act of certifying to ABC, he is doing that in his OI capacity. Now, that's not just my invention, Your Honor. That is a point that plaintiffs themselves made in the lower court. And if I may refer the court, there's a filing that was made by the plaintiffs on June 16, 2006, in the case, and there are a couple of case numbers in the lower court, they're different. It's case number 06741. It's document 40, and it's on page 7. And they made this very point themselves in response to a motion filed by Mr. Seto. They said, in fact, the SAC alleges, I'm quoting, that publishers are required to certify their paid circulation numbers to ABC every 6 months, and they cite paragraph 42 of their own complaint, and that Seto was the publisher of OI, 21.2. So Mr. Seto, when he took the sole act that is allegedly the basis for his liability, was acting in an OI capacity. Why is that relevant? Because, Your Honor, respondeat superior operates within a corporation and not across corporate lines. It does not operate from subsidiary to parent. It operates within a corporation. That's a point that we made in our opening brief in this court. It was not even responded to by plaintiffs in their reply. And it's Hornbook law. Because if the acts of a subsidiary employee could be imputed to the parent corporation, that would eliminate the corporate distinction and be the equivalent of piercing the corporate veil.
Something intervene here. He was given this title, Vice President at the Tribune. And if we construe the facts in the plaintiff's favor, why wouldn't the Tribune Company be charged with his knowledge, regardless of what other jobs he seems to have? One of them was, you know, on that masthead, vice president of the Tribune.
Because in order to have primary liability, you need two factors that work in conjunction with one another. And if you take a look at the opinion that was issued by this court in Tellabs the other day, this is the point regarding collective scienter.
Well, this is something, forgive me, I'll give you another minute for this, but I think we're going to have to require additional briefing on both Tellabs and
Stone Ridge. We'd be happy to do so.
So from both sides, and we'll give you 10 days.
Simultaneously, Your Honor?
I think simultaneously.
We'd be happy to do so, Your Honor, but let me explain the basic point. In order to have liability, primary liability under Section 10B, two things have to operate at the same time. You have to have a person that has scienter, and that person has to also commit an act that subjects the person to primary liability in connection with this. Now, the only act that Mr. Cito undertakes is not an act in his Tribune capacity. It is an act in his OI capacity.
Look, I think I understand your discussions of the various reasons that the plaintiffs have failed to show corporate scienter as opposed to the scienter of, you know, an individual person. But let's turn it around. What would be enough to attribute scienter to a corporation? I mean, clearly you think it's not enough that a vice president plead guilty to fraud. So what would be enough? Or this vice president?
Your Honor, with respect, one doesn't talk, when you're talking about the securities law, it's not a matter of imputing scienter to a corporation. At bottom, you have to have an individual who has the scienter and who is subject to primary liability, and that is what gets imputed up. So it's not as if there's some free-floating scienter that you can disassociate from the act that gives rise to primary liability. And that's
I'm not sure that you're correct on that, but go ahead.
I believe that's exactly the point, actually, that was being made in the Southland Securities case by the Fifth Circuit, and the point that was made as well in the Tellabs decision that was rendered the other day. And I'll give you another case that also addresses the same point as their Sixth Circuit authority that we can address on that. But the bottom line is, if somebody has guilty knowledge within a corporation and is standing over there but doesn't take an act that would subject him in that capacity to primary liability, his guilty knowledge is not enough for corporate scienter. It has to be a person who's making the statement that gives rise to the primary liability. It has to be a person who's contributing to it, et cetera. Now, there's another point I want to make about Mr. Cito, okay? Because it's not just a matter of capacity. There's a second area here that's important that we indicated in our original briefing. And I want to stress because it really hasn't been addressed. And that is that there is a requirement, Your Honors, that, of course, under 10B liability, that a fraud, that there must be an in connection with satisfaction. The Supreme Court has repeatedly made clear that the critical inquiry for the in connection with requirement, and remember that Section 10B talks about using or deploying a manipulative device in connection with the purchase or sale of securities. What does in connection with mean? Now, the reason that that's important is because the Supreme Court has made clear that fraud that is complete without touching on any securities transaction is not fraud that is in connection with the sale or purchase of securities. And that's a mode of analysis that the Supreme Court undertook in U.S. versus O'Hagan. It's a mode of analysis that the Supreme Court undertook in SEC versus Zanford. And in both cases, what the court said was the critical inquiry to prevent 10B from simply being a remedy for all fraud that may occur, common law fraud, is does the securities transaction and the breach of duty coincide? Is there something about the fact that there was a securities transaction that plays a role in the fraud? And here there isn't. Because according to the complaint itself, the allegation here is that this is a fraud that was directed at advertisers in order to get more revenue. The fraud's complete when the advertisers are misled and they contribute more revenues than they would already have. Whether or not the effects of that fraud then get picked up in the revenue statements of the company and communicated to investors has nothing to do with Mr. Cito's or anyone else's intent. And this goes somewhat to the question that was being asked about, you know, was Mr. Cito doing this truly for the benefit of the company or for someone else? The in connection with requirement is a way of limiting the expansiveness of 10B to the broad universe of fraud by tying it to what it was supposed to be about. If there's an attempt to deceive investors, that's one thing, but it's not supposed to be a catch-all for all common law fraud that occurs. And what has happened here is by trying to deal with a situation where a fraud is complete simply by virtue of the advertisers, and it's got nothing to do, and it's not directed at investors, and there's nothing that helps in that regard, the fact that it gets picked up and the revenues of received from investors get included in Tribune's, that's too remote. That doesn't satisfy it. So with regard to Mr. Cito, there are two primary arguments here. First, any actions that he undertakes are actions in his the only action he undertakes that's alleged is in his OI capacity, and that can't provide it be imputed to Tribune under respondeat superior. And second, whatever he does is in any event not in connection with a purchase and sale of securities, and the fact that it happens to get picked up in Tribune's revenue statements is too remote. You know, finally, the last thing I'll note is with regard to Mr. Cito and the question of the fraud on ABC, I've heard a request for an amendment in that regard. We raised this issue regarding the fact that the ABC statements were not misleading statements before plaintiffs filed their second amended complaint. We raised it in a pleading that was filed in February of 2006, if my memory serves me correctly. After that time, 3 months later, in May of 2006, they filed their second amended complaint. They didn't bother correcting it even though or making any addition or changes even though we'd already raised it. So the notion that this should now serve as the basis for amendment, that's something that's been out there all the way through this case. And in terms of, by the way, the pleading where we raised it, it's document number 70, our February 17th, 2006 reply brief. I should mention, going back to the ERISA case for 1 second, I also heard a request for amendment there. You won't find that request anywhere made below, nor will you find it in any of the appellate briefs. You heard it for the first time in oral argument now, which is why we haven't previously addressed it. That brings me then to the executive officers. Because there are four individuals, and this court is well aware of the reputational impacts of securities fraud, there are four individuals who are accused of having in some way indulged in securities fraud, and those are the four executives, Mr. Madigan, Mr. Fitzsimons, Mr. Grisenko, and Mr. Fuller. Mr. Madigan, by the way, wasn't even at the company in any capacity after December of 2002. Effectively, plaintiffs have withdrawn their allegations, which is what they made below, that there was actual knowledge of the fraud or active participation. Instead, now plaintiffs have basically boiled down their case to one of recklessness.
To one of recklessness.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
No.
And it comes down to a question of a purported alleged recklessness with regard to the adequacy of internal controls. But, Your Honors, with respect, one of the dangerous things about recklessness as a category of scienter is it sometimes becomes a substitute for nothing more than a disguised claim of internal mismanagement or gross negligence or something. That's not what recklessness is under the security laws. Recklessness is a form of a conscious disregard of truth or falsity, a not caring whether or not things are true or not true and proceeding heedless of the consequences in that regard. And with respect, Your Honor, there is not an iota of evidence not an iota of factual basis for a claim that any of these executives proceeded in any such manner. Now, I heard a bunch of things that were indicated in terms of red flags, supposedly and inadequacies of controls. Let me start out by saying, in this case, as in the ERISA case, there is a single inadequate control that is mentioned. It's in paragraph 135, and they do the same trick that was done in the ERISA case. They likewise seize upon the subsequent remedial act that was adopted in June of 2007, June of 2004, and that was set forth in paragraph 118 of the complaint. And they say, gee, it was reckless because you didn't do that earlier. Well, Your Honor, that trick was rejected by this court in the Higginbotham case very recently, where they did exactly the same thing. They tried to take a subsequent remedial act and saying, see, the fact it wasn't there means that you had reckless disregard of the truth or falsity. It supports no such thing. And, of course, saying that you add an additional requirement of quarterly certifications doesn't say a word about having any reason to believe that there is actual wrongdoing going on underneath. Now, the other thing that I heard is that there wasn't a response after the February 11th lawsuit. Well, this is true both with regard to management and with regard to the ERISA fiduciaries. What did they do? They launched an investigation. What else would you have? Now, the criticism appears to be they didn't find out the facts soon enough. Well, Your Honor, with all due respect, that's second-guessing as well. And that's exactly what this court again rejected in the Baxter versus Higginbotham case. And the claim that was made that, well, they continue to certify, give SOX certifications while the investigation was going on, that too, Your Honor, was precisely the facts in the Baxter versus Higginbotham case, where this court held that there was nothing wrong with giving SOX certifications and no evidence of fraud in connection with that unless and until they had ascertained that there was some fraud actually occurring at the subsidiary level. And there's not any pleaded facts here indicating that that's the case. Instead, what the pleaded facts tell us about the scienter or lack of scienter of the executive officers is that as soon as something came along publicly, they launched an investigation with ABC. There are elaborate attempts to conceal, including, and the complaint sends this out, false shenanigans that are taking place in terms of stagings by the people of the subsidiary during April, which prevent them from finding things out. Eventually, they discover it in June. They reveal it. They say the investigation's ongoing. They keep revealing it. Nothing about that smacks of recklessness or scienter. All that that is precisely what you'd want an executive to do, and even if you second-guess it, it doesn't add up to scienter. With respect, Your Honor, the other things that were suggested in terms of potential signs that there were recklessness here, there was reference to an SEC consent decree. Well, that consent decree is neither an admission nor denial in that regard, and it doesn't have anything to do with these four executives. And I'll tell you that what was the consent decree involved were books and records violations involving the subsidiary that are essentially strict liability matters under the SEC rules, not even a negligence standard in terms of any of this. There is not an iota of support other than the fact, when it comes right down to it, the claim that because this fraud happened, somehow these executives must have been aware of it and must have somehow disregarded it. And there's nothing in that complaint that creates a cogent and compelling strong inference as required by the U.S. Supreme Court. Your Honors, there are undoubtedly other issues to address, but I think I've about exhausted my time. And unless there are further questions, we would ask that the court affirm the dismissal of the ERISA case and affirm the dismissal of the securities case as to the Tribune and the four senior executives that I represent and not grant leave to amend, because the only leave to amend has been to include an allegation that's already been had the possibility of including, which is that a false statement was made to ABC that's already in the complaint, it's already been considered, and for the reasons that we've suggested, not only did plaintiffs deliberately fail to make that part of the complaint below when they had the opportunity, but in fact, it's legally insufficient for the reasons we've discussed. Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay, Ms. Savitt, you had used your time up, but we're going to give you an extra minute.
I really appreciate that, Your Honor. I want to make the point that it was not an insignificant fraud to Tribune, It was 15% of the publishing revenue, but 12% of the total revenue of the Tribune Company that was affected in Oi and Newsday. CETA, with regard to the question that you asked me earlier, that CETA was getting the company in trouble, so how could that be in furtherance of the corporate goal? CETA's goal, like the company's goal, was to increase the circulation numbers and the revenue. He didn't expect to get caught. The Seventh Circuit opinion in Tellab says that imputation of scienter to the company occurs when the employee attempts to act in furtherance of the corporate goal. He did. The securities plaintiffs did request amendment. Amendment would not be futile. We would plead that the ABC reports, which contain the false circulation numbers, are public documents in and of themselves, and that it was known that those circulation figures would be repeated in the 10-Ks and that would be translated to revenue that would be in all of the SEC filings. And that would satisfy the in-connection requirement. That the fraud must be in connection with the purchase and sale of securities. CETA was, we would plead certain facts that weren't pled before. The ABC reports were public and would be republished. The guilty plea of CETA, the consent decree of Tribune evidencing the lack of proper controls, that CETA was an officer of Tribune as well as the subsidiaries, that he was the mastermind of the fraud, and that he had knowledge of the fraud. It is artificial to say that a person that has knowledge of the fraud and was the mastermind of the fraud acted in one capacity but not in another. He was a vice president of Tribune, and he was in charge of Hispanic media. So there is it's a much more compelling inference to believe that he had knowledge and he acted in both capacities. And besides, that's a question of discovery, and we shouldn't be cut off at the pleading stage when the compelling inference is that he had knowledge, it should be imputed, and he acted in both capacities. Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay, and Mr. Mills. How much time does Mr. Mills have? Well, I had two different hands coming up. How much time does he have? 1 minute.
In the 1 minute, I'd like to address Summers against State Street. Mr. Graham is right. We did not move to amend in the district court. We didn't move because it would have been futile. It would have been futile because the trial court said you lose anyway under Summers against State Street. This, we say, was erroneous. If the court looks at pages 46 and 49 of the opinion, in particular below, the court talks about this was a problem, the circulation problem, but it did not rise to the level of jeopardizing the company's survival. Some cases call that the implosion standard or the verge of bankruptcy standard. The court said you would lose out because the problem doesn't reach that level. That is error of law in this circuit. We know that from Steinman against Hicks. Last paragraph. This court said in the last paragraph of that case, even if the trustees could not predict the implosion of the company, there would still be a duty to diversify if prudence required that. So that was an independent basis to dismiss. We say that was erroneous. And that's all I have.
Well, all right, one and all. Thank you. And the case will be taken under advisement.